there. We turned the tape over, Tom, and you were saying that one little girl with sickle cell.
There was I believe, a boy with sickle cell disease. There was a little girl who was hydrocephalic. There were several children who had to come in regularly for IVs, and she would do it right there in the office, and usually in the head, because it was the easiest place to hit the veins. And I mentioned to you that the needles and the stopcocks and the syringes were enormous when you compare them to what we use now. And of course, rubber tubing leading up to the bottle hanging on the stand. My job was to sit there with them. Once the IV got in, she had other work to do. And so my job, I'd have to sit there with them and make sure it was running all right and so forth. And I had that job quite often.
You were the intensive care nurse.
That's right. That's right. I wouldn't have known what to do if anything went wrong, I tell you that.
Did your mother have other assistants?
Oh, yes. She had nurses who were her very close partners who did. And I think almost everybody who worked for her was a trained nurse. There wasn't any nursing, except for the receptionist-type folks. She did all her own lab work. She looked at through the microscope herself. She did all of that herself. Pinworms were great. That's one of my favorite memories because they were so common and still are. But the way she, the easy way to find them, the cheapest way to find pinworms, provided the child hadn't had too many baths since the night before, is to take a piece of tape and put it right on the child's anus and peel it off, stick it on a slide and look at it under the microscope because you can see the eggs there. And she'd have them lined up in her little lab, and it was a curtain between the lab and her little back workroom. She'd be on the stool in front of her microscope, and the microscope there in front of her, and the child would come in. I'd be sitting back there in the background. The child would come in, lean over my mother's lap. My mother would pull down the pants, pull a piece of tape off the roll, stick it on there, stick it on the slide, push it under the microscope, and turn to Grace or Catherine or Miss Tucker, who she called Tucker, or Keeter, who she called Keeter. She called a lot of people by their last name very often. And tell them, yay, nay, yay, nay, yay, nay, you know, sort of like separating sheep from the goats. And those who had pinworms got their prescription and went on out and went down to the drugstore.
What would she have prescribed?
Antipar primarily, and it was the original agent, and it came in giant bottles, and the whole family took it for several days. Usually the whole family took the medicine for several days. I remember taking it more than once. But it worked. It was effective. Of course, they continually recurred. In the summertime then, there were, in the 50s, there were an awful lot of people still were barefooted. Sanitation was not good. So you had people getting serious cases of worms. And, of course, pinworms are not really sanitation-related very much. They're auto-transmitted. Well, pinworms, which most children get at some point or another, actually, their eggs are very hardy. The worm is a tiny little thing about less than a quarter of an inch long, and looks like a little piece of white thread, probably more like an eighth of an inch long. Comes out of the anus and lays its eggs on the outside, which causes a child to itch intensely and scratch. And then, of course, the next thing that happens with a little child is it goes in the mouth. And when it goes in the mouth, it auto-inoculates, and so they build a very large population of worms. And that's how it happens. And that's how the worm's egg gets back into the mouth, and if it doesn't go anywhere. But the eggs are hardy. They get on the furniture. They get on the drapes. When I tell people about it, they kind of discuss them. And I always love, they say, well, exactly how does a child get this? And I say, picking and licking. And hand washing and those sorts of things were even less well enforced back in those times, or just weren't available. So more than ever, those eggs were all over the place, and people picked them up easily, and so whole families got infested. And I'm sure people have low-grade pinworm infections all the time. They're just not severe enough because it takes that mouth-sucking kind of behavior to get people up to serious infection. Yeah. Anyway, there were a lot of kids with worms. There were a lot of kids with other sorts of contagious things that are acquired simply through the lack of shoes, through the lack of good sanitation, through the lack of adequate bathing facilities and those sorts of things that she saw a lot of then that we don't see now.
Can you name anything else specific?
Well, there were a lot of other worms. One of the kinds of worms is called cutaneous larva migrans, and that's when the hookworm is acquired rather than, it's the dog hookworm, and it's in the soil, and it's acquired, the larva goes in through the skin rather than being ingested, and when it gets trapped there, and it makes little tracks, it's always in your feet. It was called creeping mite, and kids came in with it all the time, and she had to, from going barefooted and dog excrement, and dogs being a whole lot more wormy than they are now, and she froze them. She used ethyl chloride, which you sprayed on out of a little spray bottle, and it shot out in a direct stream, and it did the same thing you get when you use liquid nitrogen now on skin cancers or whatever. Yeah, same sort of thing. And it would freeze them, and then, of course, the mite would die, and the child would be healed. She had to do a lot of those. I remember those well. There were a lot of traumas, a lot of barefooted kids stepping on really dirty stuff that required and all of that kind of repair work was always done in the office, all the cleaning and the repair work. If a child was completely unmanageable, he was put to sleep right there in the office by my mother, who would step to the head of the table, put the gas canister in the mask that somebody would be holding the child down, put the child to sleep quickly, step to the other end of the table and do the deed and let the child wake up. I can still remember a boy named Ned Kane violently resisting anesthesia for a big, huge splinter he had in his foot. But he wouldn't let him get close to him, and he was a big boy, and they finally had to do it. The other thing that I remember is that even though penicillin was available, ear infections very often did not always respond, and serious ear infections were treated almost entirely by meningotomy, actually draining the ear. Yeah, you remember? You must have had one.
Several.
And what she did, she carried a meningotomy knife in her pocket. It was with her all the time. It was in a little sheath that it screwed into. So she'd look in the ear, say, yeah, okay, we've got to do this. She'd pull that meningotomy knife out right there on the spot, right down through her otoscope, right there in the office. Somebody'd hold that child down. She'd slide that lancet-shaped thing. She'd clean it off with alcohol or iodine, and bam! That was it. I can still hear the screaming. I can hear one child after another hollering as she had to do that. There was a lot of screaming in there. There was a whole lot of screaming going on in that waiting room.
Did she use a suction device with her meningotomy?
No, you remember that, don't you? Mm-hmm. No, she didn't. It would have been better if she had. Probably she could have probably gotten more out. But no, she went right in, blam, and she was out of there.
Drain those eardrums.
Yeah, exactly. Get them drained. That was there. She had. I'll tell you some other things that are interesting. She had a room number two, and she went by. You didn't call it room number two. It was number two, which was always humorous to us children. But number one was a room where she really seemed to try to do almost entirely babies. Healthy babies. She segregated, sort of. And number two was sort of the operatory. It had a big table. She could do lacerations. It was where she would see a much sicker child The table was in the middle of the room, and you could go all the way around the table in the room. Number three and number four were, number four was generally for older children who came in for their checkups. I can remember many times standing to watch a pretty girl, a pretty teenage girl who was there for her physical and wanting so badly to be able to see her after the door got closed, you know, thinking, my gosh, what's under all those...
What an opportunity.
And four, she saw sicker, older children. And that was... And then five was, for the first few years, the colored room. And there was a separate examining room and a separate waiting room. And the waiting room was tiny, half as big as this room, and the examining room would have taken up the rest of it. And that was it. That was the standard in those days. The colored people came in the back door and went directly into that waiting room. They didn't have to go up front and talk to the cashier or anything. It was all done right there in the back. In many cases, they were not expected to pay. They were all considered to be so-called charity. As you know, she was a very liberal thinker, and she integrated her waiting room before the schools were integrated, and very early, and she was the first to have done so. So number five became just another room. But interestingly, a lot of the black people never really felt comfortable up in the front waiting room in that transitional time, and a lot of them never left waiting back there in number five and really preferred to be seen in number five. Didn't want to take the abuse they might take sitting out in the waiting room. But
your mother shared a story with me about taking a black infant and putting it in the only incubator that was available, I think.
Uh-huh.
Which hospital?
This one.
The red brick one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And causing a big stir. Yeah.
What do you remember about that story?
I only know that that's what she did. I do remember her. Well, she didn't have any problem. Skin color didn't mean a thing to Dr. Moline, and she was very adamant about using that incubator for a colored baby. I'm sure two-thirds of the doctors in Greenville called a nigger baby. I still remember a very prominent Greenville physician got up and walked out of our church when a black person came in, Dr. Billy Brown, one of the early chiefs of staff here. I was astounded at the level of racism in the medical community, although I certainly had plenty of it myself, having been raised in that environment. I don't remember that story. I do remember another incident that had a powerful impact on me, in which she took me out towards Chicago. She had heard that there was a baby who was in bad trouble out there, and that was common, word of mouth. Dr. Moline is a sick baby out here. They're not taking care of that baby. The baby's in trouble. All right, I'll go out there. I don't know who might call. Might be somebody in public health. Please go out there. So she'd go out there. We went out there, and we walked into a two-room shack, but a shotgun-type place. And there was no light in there. It was still daytime. I can't remember what time of day, but I'm thinking towards evening. People were lying around on mattresses. I couldn't see a baby. There were a lot of people. They were sitting, they were lying, they were kind of moving about. I really could not see a baby. And she went back into the back room and came out with this god-awful-looking, skinny, pitiful-looking baby in her arms and handed him to me and said, "Son," and turned around to people and said, "We're going to take this baby to the hospital." And she just turned around and walked out the door and said, "Son, you hold a baby. We're going to the hospital." So I carried that baby to the hospital. And I didn't even want to touch it. It stunk. You know, it was in a filthy diaper, looked like hell. And so I carried that baby to the hospital. I did tell you about the delivery, didn't I?
No.
Gosh, I haven't. Oh, that's a wonderful tale. That's one of my very favorites. I would guess I was 8 to 9 years old. It's hard to remember. We still lived on East 8th Street in the old Gaskins house. My father was out on a call, as commonly happened in the night. She said more nights than not he went out, every night. But he was out on a call, and I think Ben and Frederick had gone to bed, and I was still up. And she called up Helen White, who lived across the street, and asked her to come over and just check on the boys from time to time, but she just left them in the bed. She got this call that there was a woman in extremis trying to be delivered by a midwife out at Bruce. And Bruce is an intersection out here on the Falkland Highway. And it's still there. It's maybe another mile or two past Ironwood. And on the left there, I think still there, there was a two-story house, an old house. And we drove up into that yard. There's a sign out there right by it that's a historical marker for the home of Sally Southall Cotton.
Oh.
And anyway, so it must have been close by there. But there was a car on blocks in the yard. And every man in that house was in that car. Little boys, grown men. It must have been a whole lot of people in the house.
What
God knows how many.
Was it?
It wasn't cold. But it wasn't summer. That's what I can remember. It wasn't cold, but it wasn't summer because it was dark too early for it to be summer. And me to still be up. Maybe I just woke up when she got up. We went in the house, and in a room lit by a kerosene light was that woman and the midwife all moving about in that it's almost unreal. There's a
otherworldly.
That's correct. Thank you. In that otherworldly kind of way, everybody moving about. The mother's just, she's not screaming. She's just lying there. And then she screams with another pain. And my mother stepped up and was able to do probably some sort of a breech extraction or something. And get the baby out. The baby looked dead to me. My mother went, he wasn't, whatever. I don't even remember if it was a boy or a girl, which is surprising. You could think I looked straight at the genitals. But it was too dark in there, really. I remember her using they had boiled some water, and there were scissors and something for her to cut the cord with. She brought some bandage scissors with her to cut the cord, and going over and tending to the baby. The baby had a blanket, but with the rest of him, he was wrapped up in newspapers. And he was over there, over in the corner here, and then she delivered the placenta and proceeded to put that on newspaper and hold it in front of me, which I thought was probably the grossest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And then we got in the car and went home. I mean, the baby stayed there. I guess the baby was okay, and we got in the car and went home. I'm telling you.
That's quite a story, Tom.
There was no question, by that point, there was no question I was a doctor. Not one question in this world.
How did you feel? How old were you? How did you feel?
I think 8, 9, 10. I know that I'd already had the talk. I know that. It was after Bill Proctor and I paraded through the waiting room with the condoms. I couldn't wait to tell my friends. Of course, I absolutely couldn't wait, and I'm sure I ran to school immediately the next morning and told my friends that I'd seen a baby born and all of that stuff. But I must say to you that my feeling was, oh, okay, this is what this is about. Now I've got this one plugged in. I know how, and I was absolutely to see my mother doing that and to know what kind of competence it required and how it that was. I was real impressed that she went in with such total confidence, probably really very worried, got the job done and got out of there, and we went home. And that's what we had to do. Have we talked about the little Moy child?
I don't think we have.
Mm-hmm. I've told his story several times, too.
Let me put that one on the program for the next story time.
All right, okay. That's an unbelievable
and
tale.
Let's continue.
All right, can we continue? Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, pleasure. Yeah, it is 5:30.